We are concluding, if you can believe it, the 12 steps of AA that we've been working on for the last couple of months or so. I guess this had to be the last 3 months. There's 12 steps, right? Do the math. But today we're looking at step 12. And in the conclusion of this, it just brings everything together. I think maybe just to get started, in your bulletins, the 12th step is listed there. So just go ahead and let's take a look, take a read. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. 12 steps. There's a sense of completion. There's a sense of coming full circle. Fascinating thing to me in the Bible is numbers. Numbers are used in many different ways. Sometimes they're used to actually give us an accurate count. Often numbers are used symbolically. 12 is one of those numbers that's almost always used symbolically when it's used. It has a lot of built-in meaning. And when you think about it, 12 is always showing up. There were 12 patriarchs from Shem, the son of Noah, to Jacob, the father of the 12 sons and the 12 tribes. Jesus chose 12 apostles to carry his word out. So this 12-ness keeps coming through. In the book of Revelation, it's all about 12s. The New Jerusalem that comes out of heaven, sent directly by God, is all about 12s. Now, there's 12 gates and 12 pearls and 12 posts and 12 angels. The dimensions are 12,000 stadia square. And the height is 144 cubits, of course, which is 12 times 12. The number of the Jews who will be saved and brought into the Lamb's book is 144,000, which, of course, is a factor of 12. And so there's all this 12-ness. Why? I've seen pastors try to literally calculate the size of what the New Jerusalem would be and how many mansions you could get in there and how many people could fit. And, you know, it's missing the point that 12 means something very specifically. And as a factor of 3 times 4, which is interesting the way these ancient number systems work, 3 being the number of completion, 4 being the number of the earth, 12, 3 times 4, is the number of the completion of heaven and earth. The completion or the highest pinnacle of human government and leadership and rule. And so where you see 12s in these governmental systems, I suppose they could be called, in these ruling boards, you're seeing the completion of the highest, the patriarchs, the apostles, the 12 tribes. All of this is that 12-ness that is trying to get across there. And so why these numbers what they are? Why are they what they are? And the answer is that they're always rooted in something tangible. They're rooted in something that really is part of the common experience. When you think about it, 3, mother, father, child, the stable family is the completion of the human unit. You know, 3 legs is on a table or a stool is the minimum amount that you need for stability. And so 3 was coming to be seen as that completion, as that fullness. And 4 compass points, north, south, east, and west. You know, the 4 ways and directions that you can go on the earth. 4 seasons. And where do these numbers come from? Why does 12 then represent this complete cycle? Well, think about it. There are 12 lunar orbits in a year. That gives us our months. And the ancient peoples noticed that in every month, each lunar orbit, the sun appeared to rise in a different constellation at dawn, which gave us the 12 signs of the zodiac. Not in a weird astrological way. They used them for calculating for their crops. They were vitally important. They are hardwired into their system for survival and for life. And so 12-ness became this idea of a complete cycle from beginning to end. And the ancients always looked at time not as a linear phenomenon, but as a cycle, as a circle, the snake eating its tail, where one ending is only the next beginning. And so did the founders of AA think about all of this stuff when they came up with the 12 steps? Did they make sure that there were 12 so that they had the symbolism? I don't know. No idea. Doesn't really matter. But there are 12 steps. And they do take us on this journey. And over these last months where we've been going through this journey, you're seeing the shape. Those of you who have been with it and took a look, or you've run the steps yourselves in your lives, you've seen how it takes you on a journey that goes out and comes back again to where it starts. But the most important thing to understand is that the journey never ends. Here at the 12th step, are we finishing the steps? Are we finishing our journey? Of course not. It's only the beginning again of the next cycle. And what you see as you continue to run the steps throughout the rest of your life, either formally or informally, you find that every time you come back home again, every time you come back to where you started, you have a little more awareness, a little more presence, a little more understanding. And so the shape is as a spiral as you continue to ascend and take these, what we have called hero's journeys in here. And so I'm fascinated by the fact that this fullness, this 12-ness is built into everything that we are doing in the 12 steps. We talked about this as being in a sense, a serial surrender, starting with step one and every step, because some things are just too big to give up all at once. You just can't do it. Can't give up chocolate and cigarettes in the same week. You just can't do it. It's got to be a serial surrender, right? So that's what's happening here. And the wisdom of the steps is that we take a little bite at a time as we go. And yet, at the same time, we have to start completely on the ground. And I love the word for ground in Latin, which is humus, which gives us our word humility. So to admit that we are powerless, to admit that our life is unmanageable, to admit that there's just nothing we seem to be able to do about it, is to start right at the ground. Well, if this is a serial surrender, how does that work? I mean, how much lower can you go, right? But it turns out that there are elements, even when we admit our powerlessness, when we do that at first, it's not so much a conscious thing. It's not so much an awareness. It's more of a desperation. It's more, I just can't do this anymore. I cannot. And so you're finally ready to reach out and admit that there's a power greater than yourself that can and will restore your life to sanity and to give your life and your will over to that power. It's a beginning point. But when you come all the way around, when you've gone through these 12 steps and you come back to step one, what happens is there's an awareness that wasn't there before to what this powerlessness is all about. It changes. The desperation that you felt the first time changes to something else when you come back to it, and again and again and again. Because you are being informed and your life is being filled in ways that you can't plan and you can't foresee. You just take the journey and see what happens. And what happens is more and more you understand exactly what this powerlessness is all about in terms of your identity, your reality, and what kind of God that you're really serving through all of this. You find that the 12 steps define, take us to an awareness of this basic truth of our lives. Frank, when he spoke a few weeks ago, he talked about the 12 steps as being a restoration, a series of a restoration of relationships. First three steps being a restoration of our relationship with God. Second three steps being a restoration of a relationship with ourselves. Next three steps being a restoration of a relationship with others. And that's a really good way to look at it, this work that's being done in those first nine steps. Another way that we can overlay on top of that in terms of what's happening here in these steps, in these first three steps, we're really learning to accept ourselves, this acceptance of ourselves, who we really are. The basic nature of our powerlessness, accepting that, accepting our relationship with God as higher power, our relationship with each other as higher power sometimes as well. And so this idea of accepting the basic reality, accepting ourselves, and then step 4 through 11, all of that work that is being done is becoming yourself. First accepting yourself, now becoming yourself, bringing that into a real fruition. What does it look like to be myself internally? What does it look like to be myself in community, in relationship? What does it look like to be myself in the conscious contact with my God? What does that all look like? How do I become that? How do I even know what that looks like? It's experience. It's part and parcel to the journey itself. And then here at step 12, we move into sharing ourselves. That which we have accepted, that which we have become to know and to live, now we're in a position where we can actually share it with somebody else. Here's the thing about sharing, though. You can only give away that which you already have inside. There's nothing that you can give that you don't have. In fact, one of the ways you know you have something, that you really possess it, is whether you can give it away free and clear. You know, I got the pink slip to my old van. I can give it to Mia free and clear, sign it over, and it's hers. No strings attached. She wouldn't want it, but that's beside the point. The only way that I know that I have something to give is when I can freely give it away. That's the beauty. But here's the thing. In a sense, we're always sharing. We're never not sharing. It's just a question of what it is we're sharing. See, because before we go through these steps, what we're sharing is chaos, turmoil, hurt, leaving that wake of destruction behind us, because that's what we've got to give. Whatever we have inside is what everybody around us gets. We can't help it. It's who we are as human beings. So, by going through the steps, by taking this journey, by the time we get to step 12, we have something to give that actually is positive, something that can create insight for another person, something that can help them on their journey. That's what we're trying to get. That's what we're trying to do. And so this, knowing this true self, knowing who we really are, this process helps us to do that. How is it that we actually get to know ourselves on this journey? Just talked about these steps, 4 through 11. What is actually happening so that by the time we get to 12, we have something that we can really give to another person? Take a look on your bulletins again. There's a quote there from kind of an odd source for a Sunday morning, I suppose. This is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes. But famously, Sherlock said in one of the short stories of Doyle's that once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. I want you to think about that for a second. See, what happens on the 12 steps as we go through is we're eliminating the impossible, all right? We're eliminating those untruths about ourselves. And as we go, cycle after cycle, we eliminate more and more of these untruths until more and more what is left has to be the truth, has to be who we really are. I've used the analogy many times in here, but some of you may not have heard it, of Michelangelo, that when he was commissioned to do a sculpture, he had the ability to stand at the, you know, just a raw block of marble or stone and walk around it and envision the finished sculpture inside the heart of the stone as if it were frozen in a block of ice. He could walk around and he could see it. Every detail, every last vein and muscle, every last piece of tissue was all there in his mind. And he said the only thing left to do at that point is to remove everything that's not the horse, everything that's not the statue of David. Just remove the negative space, because he could see so clearly what was there. In a sense, that's what's going on in these 12 steps. As we move through them, there's a natural abrasion as we move along the way. And as if we are steadfast, if we stick to the task, then everything that gets removed as we move through is the impossible, is the untruth, is the negative space, and everything that is not truly us. As Jesus would say, everything that's not truly kingdom just gets chipped away as we move through. And so what is left, no matter how improbable, must be us. Robin said just now that she doesn't feel even worthy of what she got at baptism. What's improbable is that she is worthy. What's improbable is that she's a daughter of God, fully formed, even though there might still be stuff on the outside that's hiding that form. That's what's improbable. When we go through the steps, feeling the way we do, starting from step one, the sense of powerlessness, the sense of total defeat, to find out as we go through that improbable as all get out, we really are sons and daughters of God, that we have those attributes within us. How amazing is that? But it must be true, because it's the only thing that's left. What's really interesting is that there are three parts to the 12th step. The first part is a spiritual awakening. The second part is carrying the message. And the third part is putting all these principles in all our affairs. You've got three steps to it. I want to take each one just briefly so that we understand what's really going on here. So the first part is the spiritual awakening part. What is a spiritual awakening? What does that really mean? I wanted to read to you out of the 12 and 12 because I think they did such a good job of setting this stage. Right at the beginning, 12 and 12 is a book of Alcoholics Anonymous that lists the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And just let me read a couple of paragraphs. The joy of living is the theme of AA's 12th step, and action is the key word. Here we turn outward toward our fellow alcoholics who are still in distress. Here we experience the kind of giving that asks no rewards. Here we begin to practice all 12 steps of the program in our daily lives so that we and those about us may find emotional sobriety. Where the 12 steps is seen in its full implication, it is really talking about the kind of love that has no price tag on it. Our 12th step also says that as a result of practicing all the steps, we have each found something called a spiritual awakening. To new AAs, this often seems like a very dubious and improbable state of affairs. What do you mean when you talk about a spiritual awakening, they ask. Maybe there are as many definitions of spiritual awakening as there are people who have had them, but certainly each genuine one has something in common with all the others. And these things which they have in common are not too hard to understand. When a man or a woman has a spiritual awakening, the most important meaning of it is that he has now become able to do, feel, and believe that which he could not do before on his unaided strength and resources alone. He has been granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. He has been set on a path which tells him he is really going somewhere, that life is not a dead end, not something to be endured or mastered. In a very real sense, he has been transformed because he has laid hold of a source of strength which in one way or another he had hitherto denied himself. He finds himself in possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, peace of mind, and love of which he had thought himself quite incapable. What he has received is a free gift, and yet usually, at least in some small part, he has made himself ready to receive it. And AA's manner of making ready to receive this gift lies in the practice of the 12 steps of our program. And so what we're talking about here is a partnership with God. And sometimes I say that, and I get called on the carpet for it, because that's pretty presumptuous to say we can partner with God. You know, God gives us everything. God is the source of everything. And so what this amounts to is a free gift, unilaterally given by a sovereign God who needs no help in doing so, but for which we have worked really, really hard to become ready to receive. Do you see? The gift is free. To become ready to receive the gift takes everything that we've got. It takes all the stripping away. It takes you starting at the humus level, starting at the earth with a sense of absolute powerlessness. That's our part. The gift is still free. It's still unilateral, but everything that we have to do to absolutely be able to receive it takes everything that we've got. And so this is what the AA is talking about. We're able to do things that we couldn't do before because God is now working through us. Not because we're doing them on our own, because we've hitched our wagon to that power. We've hitched our wagon to that stream. The completeness then, the spiritual awakening, this free gift, is everything that we're looking at right now. How does this work? So what can we do? Are we talking about just now the spiritual awakening being the things that we do? Is it a following of God's will? Is it a following of the law? Is that what we're talking about? Is that what this is? Obedience shows us the fact that we have now had the spiritual awakening. I want to read you from Paul. I think he illustrates this really well. Famous passage at Romans 7. I do not understand my own actions, he writes, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree with the law, and that is good. So now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is, in my flesh. For I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil that I do not want is what I keep on doing. Now if I do what I do not want, which is no longer what I who do it, but sin dwells in me. So I find it to be a law that when I want to do right, evil lies close at hand. For I delight in the law of God, in my inner being, but I see in my members another law, waging war against the law of my mind, and making me captive of the law of sin that dwells in my members. Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? Here's a conflicted guy, I'll tell you that right now. He's trying so hard to do what is right, and he's having the darndest time. This is what I love about our scriptures. They just paint everybody just as they are. No whitewashing here. No trying to show a good face. Here's Paul really going through it. But take a look at what he writes just a few years later at Philippians 4:4, starting, "Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. Let your reasonableness be known to everyone. The Lord is at hand. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your request be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. What you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at length you have revived your concern for me. You were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. Not that I am speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me." Does that even sound like the same guy? Wow. Wow. See, this is the difference between trying to grind out obedience versus this joy of living that A.A. talks about. This 12-step takes us into a joy of living, changes everything. How in the world are you still obeying anybody if it is your greatest joy to do the things that the law talks about? This is where we're trying to get at. This is what we're trying to move toward. The spiritual awakening is not just about doing these things that we are now capable of doing. There's something deeper than that, and we have to take a look at what that deeper thing is. What is it that's talking about? Okay, so is it this joyful living then? Right? Is that what we're talking about? Well, Jesus seems to say so. Take a look at Matthew 13. He talks about the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in the field, which a man found, and he hid again, and from joy over it, he goes and sells all he has to buy the field. And again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls, and finding one, a pearl of great price and great value, he went out and sold all he had and bought it. And so you have this sense of joy, this excitement, you know. Sometimes AA folks call about the pink cloud when they finally found this connection and they feel that sense of excitement and exuberation. And this going out and selling everything, letting go of everything in order to be part of that. So then, is our spiritual awakening an emotion? Is it the joy that we feel here? You know, the thing to really think about is the pink cloud, the joy, the exuberance, is a byproduct of the awakening, but it's not the awakening itself. And that's a fine distinction, because we are so tuned to our emotions. We think we've had a spiritual experience when we feel it, but if we don't feel it, then we think that something's wrong. But in this case, what we're trying to get at is that distinction. Yes, the result of living these steps, the result of getting out to a place where we can do things that we couldn't do before, have relationships we couldn't have before, gives us this sense of joy. But it's not the joy that defines the awakening either. Becoming aware, becoming awake to God's presence, working through this practice of finding exactly what that means in our lives. How are we present to God? How do we practice God? It gives us a sense of identification, who we really are. Just as Robin was baptized today, she has told all of us her identification is with God and no longer with anything else that she was clinging on to before. but it'll take the rest of her life to continue to chip away everything that is not of that identification. And every cycle will bring her closer and closer together, just as every one of us has gone through the same process. There will be a sense of contentment. There will be a sense of optimism. I mean, how optimistic are we all? But a sense of optimism about our life, even in the face of a world that seems to be coming off the rails. There will be a sense of forgiveness, a lack of resentment toward those who perpetrate against us. That will be there. Not necessarily, though, the pink cloud. That comes and goes with time. But what remains if we've had the spiritual awakening is really the absence of anxiety, the absence of stress, the absence of that feeling that I don't know if everything is going to be okay. You put all that together, and we have a word for that, typically serenity. There is a sense of serenity that starts to come over us, not necessarily an exuberance, not necessarily experienced as what we would call joy, but the absence of everything that points to fear as being the basis of our lives as opposed to trust. And if there is one word that I can come to that tells us when we've had our spiritual awakening, it's trust. Trust is what gives us the sense of okayness. Trust is what obliterates the anxiety and the stress. And trust can only be gained experientially. There is no way that you can take it out of a book. You have to live it. You have to repeatedly experience the trustworthiness of God before you will trust Him. And so this trust becomes this huge piece. And so now we come to the second part. This is carrying the message, sharing ourselves. So do we need to be fully, completely, spiritually awake before we can share ourselves with another person? Is that the case? Reminds me of a joke. I get to tell the joke now. Two men are backpacking in the woods following a path, and they happen to meet each other. And so they decide to walk together for a little bit. They turn a corner, and they come face to face with a bear. And they freeze in their tracks. You probably heard this one, some of you. One of them immediately drops down, fishes out his running shoes out of his backpack, and starts unlacing his boots and putting on. The other guy says, "What are you doing? There's no way you can outrun a bear." He says, "I don't have to be faster than the bear. I only have to be faster than you." Now think about that for a second. I don't have to be perfect. I don't have to be fully formed. I just have to be a little more stable than you in order to be able to help. It's progress, not perfection. That's the way this works. If we waited to be faster than the bear before we started running, we would never run. If we waited to be perfect before we ever helped anyone, we would never help anybody. All we have to do is just have a little bit of awareness, a little bit of presence, a little bit of understanding that gets us a little bit further down the road so that we can turn and see someone who's still in that other state, and we can reach and we can help them and we can give them at least what we've got. It may be pathetically small, but it's something for them. It works. So we don't have to wait. No, it's not about being perfect. Ultimately, again, you got to understand, the only way that we know we have something is when we give it away. If you think you've had any kind of spiritual awakening, how are you going to know for sure? When you have enough freedom from fear to be able to freely give it away, with no strings attached, with no thought of anything in return, no requirements, and even to somebody that you think really doesn't deserve it, that's how you know that you really have this thing. And here's the thing, how are we ever going to understand how we are loved by our God? How are we ever going to understand, as Robin said, that we are really worthy of this free gift that God continues to shower upon us? It's when we first feel that love leaving us, going towards someone who is just as undeserving as we are, when we see ourselves able to give love to that person, then we finally understand how it's possible for someone to give love to us. We have to see it in action. We have to feel what it feels like. That's why Jesus made such a big deal about loving the enemy. It's not about loving those who love us, loving those who give something back to us. That's easy. We can all do that. But this other piece transforms everything. And we finally start to understand what it really means. I hope that this will make this beatitude, just the fifth beatitude, just fly off the page. Take a look at Matthew 5:7. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Now, when we see that and we think of that, it's like, okay, I'm going to do this good thing over here. I'm going to get lots of brownie points. I'm going to get, you know, check marks after my name up in heaven. And then over here sometime, probably at the moment of my death, I'm going to get the mercy as well. So it's a quid pro quo. I do this and separated in time, I'm going to get something back. That's the way we look at it. It's an if-then statement. It's a work and reward type of thing. We know that. We understand that. We go work, we get paid. That's what we're thinking here. But in kingdom, everything is here. Everything is now. Everything is one thing. What Jesus is trying to get across to us is when we give mercy, when we let fly with gifts that are completely free to a person who doesn't deserve it, at that moment, we understand what mercy is all about and we receive it. There is no other way to do this. It is in the giving that we receive. It's all one thing. It happens simultaneously. There's no separation in time. And we finally understand what it means as it leaves us and it becomes real in another person's life. This third part, practicing the principles in all our affairs. This is where it comes back to ground again. This is where everything starts to make sense. Because the 12th step has to be more than just service. It's not just about doing those things, even the things that we couldn't do before. There's something else that takes place. The helping others, the service that we perform, is actually the byproduct of the spiritual awakening, of this joy of living that starts to creep up on us. Waking up to all of life creates this joy of living that we're talking about. And we can't contain it. It just bursts at the seams. It has to get out. Jesus called it a light on a hill that you don't put under a bushel. You just open it up and everybody can see it for miles around. He called it salt and light, giving the preservation of life and the zest to life and the illumination and insight and understanding. And you just can't help it. It's just who you are. And so this is who we become when we move down this. I got two quotes there from two of my favorite people, Francis of Assisi and Augustine of Hippo. And Francis is credited with saying, preach the gospel continuously. Use words where necessary. Got it? Close our mouths and move our bodies in rhythm with the way of Jesus. Live this thing. Have it just oozing out our pores. People will come and ask us questions, and we can use those words, but it had to come from someplace before that to give it the authority that Jesus has talked about as having. Augustine said, love God and do as you please. Recipe for absolute disaster in the wrong hands, right? But if you really love God, everything you please is only what pleases God. How can it be otherwise? You have become one. Your life, your rhythms have become in sync with God's life and God's rhythms. Nothing can go wrong in such a circumstance. You know, we come full step, full circle in the 12 steps back to powerlessness. To be free of this fear that creates in us this distaste for the dependence and the vulnerability and the imperfection of our powerlessness. This is what we become freed of. The first time that we have to face our powerlessness that gets us started on this path, we hate it. It reeks of desperation. It reeks of defeat. But to go all the way around this process and come back, knowing who we are, or a part of that for the first time, and we realize who we are these powerless, dependent, vulnerable, and imperfect creatures of God who are also loved with an incredible love that can never be lost. Where else would you rather be? The blissful child who doesn't have to worry about the adult's world, the parents' world, and how to pay the bills, and how to make sure there's food on the table. All they have to do is just be in the house, and they get showered with everything that they need. That freedom can be ours. And we will learn to love our powerlessness, not fear it, not loathe it, not see as it any as any kind of defeat for us. And so we start to realize, like Jesus said, the treasure is already here. The pearl is already here. We don't have to go out and find it. The beautiful thing about those two men and those two parables, when they went out and sold everything they had, it wasn't to find kingdom. It wasn't to find their meaning and purpose. They already knew exactly where it was. And so do we. Jesus has told us over and over again, the kingdom is here. It's now. It's within. It's among. It's in the midst of. It's all those things at the same time. We know exactly where it is. All we have to do is continue to strip away everything in us that's not kingdom so that we can receive it. Which means we don't have to go searching all the time. The one last thing I wanted to bring to your attention, take a look at that picture in your bulletins if you've got it. Do you love that? I just love that shot. Two little girls standing on a grate, Marilyn Monroe style, just letting a subway blow underneath them. What that must feel like. I want to read you just a little bit of a blog post I did based on this. Someone recently told me that he needed excitement in his life, that there was nothing to look forward to. Someone else was telling me that she was completely dry, and the work she used to love was uninspiring and dead to her now, that the co-workers and clients that she still loved deserved more and better than she could deliver. I could certainly understand. I'm sure we've all been there, done that, feeling the edges of burnout or ennui crowding into the corners of our eyes and threatening hostile takeover. Truth is, regardless of how we view them, our lives are made of moments, nothing more. Just a string of moments from birth to death. Or better, a single moment constantly changing in its detail and composition. And most of those moments, or the details of that one moment, are usually pretty ordinary, commonplace, what we'd call boring from a certain point of view. We keep looking for our moments to inspire us, to fill us from the outside with the meaning we can't find on the inside. But this moment right now, like an island, is self-contained. If we don't bring meaning here, we won't find it here. The circumstances of our moments have no intrinsic meaning. Everything in life is equally meaningless or meaningful, depending on what we bring to the party. If we spend our moments waiting for or trying to manufacture those rare peak exciting moments, then our lives become flyover country, like the plains of Nebraska we fly over to get to the coasts. And all those precious moments viewed from 30,000 feet appear flat and dimensionless. But we are all just a moment away from transformation. And when we can simply revel in the warm updraft from a grate ballooning our skirts, when we can come back down to earth and fill our moments with our presence, our moments will be full of presence, exciting and meaningful, and not a moment before. Step one is painful the first time. It's devastating. But from step 12 back to step one, coming full circle, brings us to the joy of this powerlessness, of just being able to be like children and enjoy the sense of dependence and connection to a God that never withholds anything from our lives. And that freedom from fear that makes our powerless vulnerability in God's life and God's embrace, it makes it all just a joy of being able to live. This is the completion of one cycle of our 12 steps in a never-ending cycle of steps in our journey, deeper and deeper into a God that can't love us anymore and can't love us any less. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the experience and wisdom and insight of the people around us. Those that we are living with, those that we meet and speak with, and those that speak to us through their writing and through other means. Thank you for their experience of you and your grace and your love that we can use to be able to engage our own journeys. Help us to engage, Father. We want to leave no stone unturned and to be able to find out exactly who we are in you, who you are, who it is that we really serve, and what that means to our moments. You're our God when we're your people. And the only way that we can love is because you loved us first. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Let's all stand.